This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place Nation Pop Experience, Pop Goes to the Couch, is back after a brief hiatus, brief-ish, I don't know. We go by the Disney Plus and other various and sundry streaming series out there. Just wasn't anything for us to chat on a regular about, and we are a week late. We apologize, scheduling stuff gets in the way, but we are back. Two-thirds of us, the rest of the crew are here. Sean Kidd, of course, is on assignment. He's over in London, supposed to bring back some, nice, lovely things from the gift shop of the, I think it's the British Museum, I think, or whatever it's called, with the, some antiquities, some knockoffs, cheap knockoffs. If we know Sean, it'll be cheap knockoffs. Anyway, I'm Andy Atherton. I'm here as your moderator, host, ringmaster, ring team, whatever you want to call it, the guy that keeps the action flowing, and the guys that they'll break it down and give us the great commentary. One of them is Scott Shiflett. Hey, Scott.
This is Matt now. Nope, wait, I'm Scott again. Hey, it's good to be back, Andy.
All right, we got multiple personalities. You didn't have a Boston accent, though, when you were Matt. Sorry. So I didn't really buy it. All right, also to break it down, though, is Tim Capel. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Double A. Yes, welcome back to Pop Goes to the Couch / Basement. We are at the mercy of the content that we cover. So, yeah, a little bit of a break, but here we are again. I am a used goods store in Egypt as my alternate personality and my sexuality as well. Yeah, it's a shame Sean is not with us, but good to have most of the crew at least as we dive into a brand new series here from Disney Plus and Marvel.
Yeah. Well, also speaking of our schedule, we have talked about, might as well just get out of the way. We have talked about doing some episodes, interlude episodes, I guess we'd call them, in between streaming series, just because there are other shows we all watch and we all like, mm-hmm. we'd all like a chance to talk about. It's just not stuff we would cover like on a weekly basis. You know, there have been so many great series in the last 6 months to a year that I've watched that I've wanted to just say a few words on with these guys. I know they're, Tim and I have both watched Yellow Jackets. I would have just finished The Flight Attendant. I'm finishing Kevin Can Fuck Himself. I know Sean and Scott watched Yellowstone in 1883 and other in Succession.
Whoa. I did not watch Yellowstone in 1883. That's nip that in the bud real quick. That's an old person show.
Oh, Andy. All right. Sorry, I apologize. But, there are other shows like Scott, you watch Succession and other things. So we might do episodes where we might just, talk about a few shows that we've watched over the last few months. So look for those coming when we're in between current series that we're covering. So that's a mouthful, but just want to get that out of the way. So here we are on Moon Knight. This is a character I know very little about. You guys all know that I am I am fully on embrace the host role on this show, that I am not the expert ever. I have a Moon Knight action figure. I know very little about it. So let's kind of go around and we'll talk about the character and when they announced Moon Knight was going to be a series and what are your thoughts on, and then what do you think of casting Oscar Isaac as the lead? So we'll start with you, Scott. Scott, what did you think of when they announced that we were getting a Moon Knight series?
Well, to be honest, I didn't know much about Moon Knight when it was announced. My little brother loves Moon Knight. It's one of his top three favorite characters. So I knew some about it from him. So I hit him up and asked him some stuff about the character. And it sounds very interesting. It sounds like it's basically like the Marvel version of Batman, to be completely honest. We're not seeing that in the show as much. But like Batman with dissociative identity disorder. I think I said that right. But no, it's like the Marvel take on that. It's very interesting. With Oscar Isaacs, I was shocked that he jumped into another Disney universe after being on Star Wars. But I enjoy him as an actor. And I know my co-host here has had some issues with Steven. But Steven, but likes Mark. And I think he's done a good job of like saying – tell them the difference between each one so far.
Yeah, it's I totally had something to say and I totally forgot. It was good enough for Ming-Na, who's been in both. It's good enough for Oskik, right? Oskik. Oh, Jesus Christ. So see what happens when you take some time off from doing pods, you're off a cock.
Yeah.
Tim, what are your thoughts on Moon Knight? Thoughts when they announced the series and thoughts on Oscar Isaac as the lead. Just cast as the lead. We'll talk about him as we go through the character as his portrayals, but just before you saw episode one, that's where your thoughts are.
Character Moon Knight, I've always thought he's a really captivating character, at least visually. He's never been like a favorite of mine as a comics reader, but anytime he would show up as like a guest star or just kind of a supporting player, which happened a lot throughout the 90s, he would kind of pop in for these sort of big events. He always, you know, left a pretty positive impression on me. I mean, he dates back to the 70s. First appearance was in a Werewolf by Night comic in 1975. So kind of a weird history. I know that visually he definitely evokes Batman, and he often does get called the Marvel version of Batman. And I can see where people do kind of have that takeaway, but I mean, when you look at him personality wise and sort of his origin and his history, I mean, it's really not at all like Batman. There are certain things that they do that are almost like a commentary on some of the Batman tropes that are there just to sort of almost say, no, really, he's not Batman. He's his own thing. And this is why, like, there isn't a Marvel version of Batman, because our heroes are rather messed up in ways that the DC icons, the paragons of virtue that they are not. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I can see how people get that impression, but really there's been a lot of work done to differentiate him from Batman in a lot of ways. So I was really looking forward to this series just because he is such a lesser known character that seemed like he'd be perfect for a Disney Plus project, whereas you'd think maybe he can't necessarily carry a movie. That's debatable, but just seems perfect for something like this, where you see like Daredevil, he works really well in a serialized television format. So why not take the same approach with Moon Knight and get him some more exposure? As far as the casting of Oscar Isaacs, I mean, I really like him as a performer. And yeah, I mean, it just seemed like it fit. I don't know what it is about him exactly, but I could just totally picture him portraying Moon Knight in all of his forms. So right from the jump, like when all of that was announced, I was like, yeah, I'm super on board with this. It was one of the more anticipated Disney Plus projects for me, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Actually, the most watched premiere as well, from what
was it really?
What they've said that it was, it beat WandaVision actually the first episode.
That's
so.
Shocking. Okay.
Well, I think we haven't had, it's been a little bit, right? We've had for a series. We've been.
Yeah, I'm just surprised it beat WandaVision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think maybe this could be the way new to the MCU, unknown characters maybe get introduced this way and not as much in the movies, although we are getting America Chavez introduced in the Doctor Strange movie. Actually, it's coming out less than a month. Holy shit, seems like it's been forever for that.
I know.
All right. So let's get into doing what we do here and break it down. So we're talking about season one, episode one. This is the Goldfish Problem, the pilot, basically. We have Arthur Harrow drinking. He unfolds a piece of cloth on the table in front of him. He wraps his shot glass into the cloth and smashes it with his metal staff, pours the glass shards into his shoes and puts them on his bare feet and calmly walks out. You know, this scene gave me the heebie-jeebies, and I'm sure Sean has the same sentiments. But Stephen Grant then wakes up in his flat. He's puzzled and finds himself strapped to the bed. He frees himself and finds sand on the floor and also finds his door taped shut. Stephen feeds his one-finned goldfish and leaves a voicemail for his mother saying that he got her postcard and goes to his job as a gift shop attendant at the British Museum. He manages to catch his bus and talks to a visiting girl about mummification. A co-worker, Donna, goes past him with boxes and has Stephen help her with them. She reminds him that he is not a tour guide and reminds him that he's just supposed to sell snacks to the children. So we get the introduction to, from what I've been told, going into the series, is our villain, Arthur Harrow, our Ethan Hawke, doing a Kevin Bacon cosplay, in my opinion. And we get our first intro into to Stephen Grant. So, Scott, what did you think of the start of the series?
It was very disturbing with, like, I don't even know why I'm telling you this. You guys, this is just going to open me up. One of my big fears is to have, like, something, like, happen to, like, my hands or my feet or my eyes. And him stepping on glass is, like, just terrible. It feels horrible. And but it sets the stage, because I thought it was going to be Stephen Grant, you know, Oscar Isaac's character, but it wasn't. It was Arthur Harrow, which we didn't know his name yet. We learn it later this episode. And then we see Stephen Grant, but it's like, what the hell is going on here? He is chained to a bed, and he has, like, his door is taped shut to see if he didn't go anywhere. So it's like, we're starting off on a weird foot. And we see it as a goldfish. And I did like how he was in the gift shop because we think, like, he's maybe a guide for the British Museum, because he's, like, telling, like, all this stuff to this little girl. And, like, the little girl's, like, soaking it in. Then we get the bitch manager who's like, yeah, you need to help me with this. You need to do this. And, like, then she says, like, you're on inventory, because he has a thing of running late, and he's just supposed to sell snacks to the children. So it, like, sets the stage early that, like, he's always wants to be something more than he is.
Yeah. He's, like, just know all this stuff. He's got all this information, but he's a lowly gift shop attendant. Tim, what'd you think of the start of the episode?
That first introduction to Ethan Hawke's character, which we knew he was going to be in the show, Ethan Hawke, but we weren't really sure exactly what, in what capacity and what role he was going to be taking on. So as I understand it, this Arthur Harrow is an original character. He's not like somebody plucked from the comics. So can't really form much of an opinion or have a preconceived notion about this character, since he's truly just invented for the show. But yeah, that scene totally, like, ooged me out right away. I don't really share exactly the same phobia as Scott, but certainly somebody deliberately putting broken glass in their shoes is like, ugh. Just, yeah, he definitely left an immediate impression. Scary first impression. Then we meet Stephen Grant, who, I guess, between the shackles and the door being taped shut, it's given you the sense that this is a guy who's dangerous and knows that he's dangerous in some ways. But then, as we see him go throughout his day, his work day, he's kind of just this schlub. He's badly mistreated by his coworkers, who seem to have no respect for him. And it's like, so how is this guy, this sort of nebbishy guy, you know, what is there that we should be, you know, fearful of, or why is he having to do this, to shackle himself at night? Like, does he have a sleepwalking problem? What's really going on? So yeah, it's a good little setup from the jump here.
All right. So, Dylan comes over and chats with Steven, asks if they're still on for the next night for their date at a steakhouse. Steven doesn't remember and asks her if she's asking him out. Dylan figures he's joking and walks off. Donna, the bitch manager, comes over and jokingly congratulates Steven and reminds him that he's a vegan. Steven and Donna go to the back to check inventory, and she tells him that he was late again. He says that the banners are showing 7 Enad members of the Egyptian mythology when there should be 9. Donna isn't impressed and tells him to get to work. At the end of his workday, Steven leaves and stops at a sidewalk vendor to get a bite to eat and talk to a street performer about his amnesia issues. Before he goes to bed, Steven spreads fresh sand on the floor to catch his footprints. If he walks off and tapes the door shut, locks the door, and restrains himself to the bed. Steven then tries to stay awake, working puzzles and reading books on Egyptian mythology. He finally dozes off and wakes up the next morning in a field, his jaw dislocated. Steven realized that he's in the Alps near a village and hears a voice in his head telling him to go back to sleep, and he's not supposed to be there. The voice tells Steven to surrender the body to Mark and realize that the idiot is in control. Stephen finds a golden scarab in his pocket and turns to find a chalet behind him. A man is looking out the window and Stephen waves to him. The man waves back, and then that man and another shoot at Stephen. The voice tells Stephen to run, and Stephen does so. The men chase him, and Stephen runs into the village, avoids more men with guns, and tries to blend in with some of the tourists. So we'll take a pause there because we have a lot of action going on over the next a bit. So, Tim, you know, we get now, you know, Stephen's amnesia. We get more of the bitch manager, and now we find him waking up. We show what he has to do every night, actually, to kind of deal with whatever's going on with him. And then he just wakes up in the Alps. What the hell's going on here?
Yeah, well, we see why he's so afraid to go to sleep. Right away, they waste no time in getting us into the thick of the action here. I will say at this point that I found the accent of Stephen Grant to certainly be a choice by Oscar Isaacs. I mean, I know he's doing that on purpose, and I know it sounds very manufactured, and I gather that it's supposed to, but it's also just still kind of grating. So I don't know, that still is like, it just bothers me. And I know that it's just kind of supposed to, but I also just can't get past it. So I'm having a hard time with that, but, yeah, with the way that he wakes up and is like in this, you know, firefight basically, and is being ordered around by this like somewhat imperious, dickish sounding voice in his head. Already I'm sort of putting the pieces together. I'm like, okay, so they're going for the DID angle with this character. They're talking about Mark, so that must be Mark Spector, you know, the mercenary personality who actually is the Moon Knight vigilante, right? And Stephen Grant, that personality in the comics is like a rich guy, kind of a Bruce Wayne, but they're not really going for that angle in the show, which is fine. And I'm like, okay, I kind of see what we're doing here. And I'm with it for the most part, but I don't know. There's going to be some, as we move along, talk about a comparison to Batman. There's a comparison to another character that I started to draw as this thing progressed. So we'll get to that momentarily.
And that voice is actually played by the great actor F. Murray Abraham.
Uh-huh.
He's the voice of Khonshu. So yeah, they, you know, that's, you know, you can't believe that you never like see Oscar winners. I mean, this guy, I believe, won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor from Deus, for crying out loud. All right, Scott, what did you think of this part of the episode?
I jumped ahead when I was talking about the asshole boss of Donna with the inventory, but it shows that, like, you know, he knows more about the Egyptian mythology than the people who run the museum, with him saying it should be 9 instead of 7. And I do think it's funny that he gets this date and they're like, they're all for a steakhouse. And she's like, oh, you're a vegan. So it's like, was this Mark that was talking to Dylan? And he didn't even realize it. Like, how bad are his issues? And you also feel kind of bad for him because he's talking to the street performer who their whole job is not to talk. And you don't even, the guy's like looking at him. And it's just, it's kind of heartbreaking because I don't think that, Stephen has many friends. And to be honest, we see him talking to his mom, quote unquote, on this, like leaving voicemails for his mom in this first episode. And I don't even think she's real. Like, I think it's like he's just leaving some random voicemails for someone. And it's kind of just heartbreaking and sad, to be completely honest. And then like when he finally goes to bed after he does like his nightly check, like my nightly check, like I lock the door and turn the alarms on. This man ties himself down like it's Fort Knox or something. So, but like when he wakes up and like, you know, he's trying to stay awake by reading books on Egyptian mythology, that put my ass to sleep. Maybe he should start with like a Jack Ryan book or something. I don't know. I'm just throwing stuff out there for you, Stephen. But he wakes up and like it looks like his jaw's messed up and everything, and like the voice, which I know Tim, you're not a fan of, it's like, oh, surrender the body, and he's like, what? The idiot's in control. And it's like, oh my god, where the hell are we at? Because we went from London to, like you said, a village, and that seems to be way out there. And yeah, and business is about to pick up, as they say.
Yeah, one thing about this episode too, you can mark, is tremendous editing. There is some like I tell the guys off mic, like I was a little tired when I watched this, so I think I was like a little like, what's happening here? Like I was like, I wasn't on my my complete senses were not all, I guess, in tuned. But yeah, this is I just had it playing on, it just completed, and tremendous editing to go between his little spells, so to speak, that he's about to go through. So the tourists all kneel to Harrow, who walks past them. They gather around him, and he talks about the darkness, and they're there to make Earth as much like heaven as possible. A man steps up, and Harrow praises him as brave, that he's a man offering up his soul for judgment. Harrow takes the man's wrist, and Stephen sees a tattoo of a scale on Harrow's arm. He places his staff on the man's wrist, and the tattoo of the scale turns green. Harrow says the man is good and hugs him. The man with guns arrive, and Stephen tries to slip away. An old woman says that she has to know and goes up to Harrow, and he judges her. The scales turn red, and he tells her that Amnet has decided, and he wishes the woman could see the world they make, and she collapses dead. And one guard comes over and tells Harrow that someone ambushed them and killed two of their men, and they think Stephen is still there. Harrow yells in Egyptian. Everyone kneels except Stephen. When Harrow sees Stephen, he calls him a mercenary. Stephen has no idea what the older man is talking about. Harrow tells Stephen to return the scarab. Stephen takes it out of his pocket. The voice tells Stephen that he'll give Harrow nothing, and Stephen's body acts on its own and refuses to give Harrow the scarab. The cultists grab Stephen and try to pry the scarab from his hands, and Stephen blacks out. When he wakes up, he's covered in blood and surrounded by dead cultists. The voice in his head that the idiot is back, and Stephen runs off past Harrow and the other cultists. The cultists then close in on him, and Stephen takes a cupcake delivery truck and drives out of the village and down the highway. The cultists drive after Stephen, and he pulls past a farmer on his way, who gives him a finger. As the cultist jumps onto the back of the delivery van, he comes through the back, and Stephen slams the cupcakes into his face. He then blacks out. When he wakes up, he finds himself holding the boarder's gun, and the board in the back is a back shot to death. We're going to cut a promo on this person. The voice... Well, what the fuck is a boarder? Anyway, the voice warns Stephen about an oncoming truck, and Stephen manages to avoid it. Two of the cultist cars pull up, and the men prepare to shoot Stephen. He blacks out, and then he wakes up, finds himself driving evasively backwards. One cultist car pulls up against the hood, and Stephen throws his gun at it. The cultist van pulls up in front of him, and the shooters get out, prepare to shoot Stephen, and the lumber from the truck Stephen knocked off the road earlier hits and kills them. So, whew, gotta take a pause, because I need to rest for a second. This, like, as Scott said, business really does pick up. So, Scott, what do you think of this little section of this action sequence, I guess, so to speak?
Well, we finally get to see Harrow in action, which is pretty interesting. With he seems to be a type of a cult leader, which I find very, very interesting. And I like his little tattoo, which we've seen where it, like, if you're good, it goes green, and if you're bad, it's red. And it doesn't seem to judge you for what you've done in the past. It seems like it's sort of like a minority report type thing, where if, like, you do something, if they can see you doing something bad in the future, that's how you get taken out. Because the woman that gets killed, it seems like Arthur sucks her life force out of her, that, like, she's like, I never did anything bad. So if that's true, and, he says that Amit judges her. If that's true, then Amit can see the future and see that, like, she might not be a great person. Maybe she, like, spits on homeless people, kicks puppies or whatnot. So, like, it's like a sort of little bit of a Minority Report type vibe where, like, he judged her, turned to red, sucked the soul out, which I thought we needed to see something bad from him. And, as we'll get with the second episode, with the first episode, he seems like a total piece of shit bad guy here. And it has to set the stage, because we got to have heroes and villains, because this is only a 6-episode series. And I liked how Harrow then, like, when he yelled in Egyptian and Steven's slow on the uptake, and they think that it's, the Merc. And I know that Moon Knight is extremely violent, and the way I like their little way of how they're getting out of it with Disney is like Steven blacks out, you know, his side, like the other side of him takes over, and like Mark takes over and kills everyone, and he wakes back up again, and it's nothing but dead bodies. It's a nice little way they can get out of this and still keep it PG, PG-13, which I liked. I really did enjoy the scene where like where he's shoving the cupcake in the guy's face, and then he wakes up, and the guy's dead in the back. Everyone, he's holding the gun, then he throws it, and like the voice in his head's like, the idiot just threw a gun, and I really enjoyed the scene. I know, you know, you can be picked apart, but when I watch these shows, I just try to lose myself in them and get myself into this world.
Mm-hmm. All right, Tim.
So when we see Arthur Harrow perform his little ritual, and he does kind of come off like a cult leader, as Scott mentioned, I'm still in that mode of trying to figure out what pre-existing character this is supposed to be. And so when I saw his tattoo of the scales do its little, I don't know, it was animated, right? When he read the two people, and I'm thinking, okay, scales, Marvel Comics, is this the character Libra? And I wondered if they were from a group called the Zodiac. And I wondered if they were maybe setting up, which is kind of what you would expect it to be. It's 12 characters patterned after the, you know, the astrological symbols. Oh, okay. And they're kind of, and they are kind of cult like, and they're kind of nuts. Individually, like, there aren't that many like prominent members, but Libra was sort of one of them who did have like some stories to himself, and I'm like, is that what they're going for? But I'm like, nah, then he sort of evokes like some Egyptian gods, and I'm like, I don't know. I think that's like a lot. So I think we're sticking with the Egyptian gods and goddesses for this show, which I sort of appreciate, because in the MCU we've established that like the Norse gods are real, right? And with Asgard and everything. So why not some Egyptian gods to go along with it? Maybe we'll get some, you know, in the next Thor movie, maybe we'll see some Greek gods and goddesses and stuff like that. So just, I like that sort of how it's fleshing out the world, doing some major world building in terms of these like various deities that seem to actually exist. So anyway, moving on from that, here's where I'm starting to get a tiny bit frustrated, because I'm feeling like I'm three steps ahead of the character in the show. Like I get what's going on, right? He's switching between identities, but we're following the Stephen Grant personality as our point of view character, so we don't get to see what he does as Mark Spector. However, I'm getting a little bit annoyed with the Stephen Grant character. I want to see more of Mark. I want to see the action, right? I mean, it's a clever editing device, to your point, Andy, absolutely, but I sort of want to see it at the same time. And I'm like, I think we, you know, I don't think I'm unique in that respect of knowing that that's what we're doing here. We're kind of going back and forth. And it's just, I just think we've seen and we get what type of story this is. So why not like get down to business? It just feels like they're sort of, spending too much time on this, and maybe that's just me being impatient, but I'm like, all right, the protagonist, our main character, needs to catch up with where the audience is, because we know what kind of story we're watching here. He doesn't know what kind of story he's in. He needs to get on the same page as us. Let's move it along. And it was just sort of taking a little too much time for me, but
yeah,
again, I'm maybe being impatient.
Yeah. I think possibly. Cause it's like, when you know, I guess for me, like I tell you guys, like, ignorance is bliss when it comes to this stuff for me. Like, I'm a blank slate, so I don't have, but I can imagine when they have characters that are original, like this character, it must drive you batshit crazy. You were probably sitting there like way overthinking it. I'm just like, all right, it's Ethan Hawke. He's a cult leader. Don't know who he is, but he's going to be our antagonist here. And you're like sitting there going, fuck, who is this guy? He's part this, yeah, part that. Yeah. Like Charlie Day with the string theories, all that stuff.
Exactly.
Going. Yeah. So.
And at the same time, the stuff with the main character, I'm like, I get it. Like, I know where they're going with this. Like, let's keep it moving, you know? Mm-hmm. And they seem to just be, I won't say they're not beating you over the head with it, but I just think it went on past the point of, okay, we get it. We're not dumb. This is not our first rodeo with this, you know, superhero genre, or even this kind of story where it's a guy who has multiple personalities. So I just wish they would keep it moving. Like, as I said, we've only got 6 episodes here. So, maybe anyway, I'll stop there because we, we do have a reveal coming up.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So Stephen blacks out and wakes up in his bed in London. He's restrained to the bed and the door's tape is in place. Stephen figures that he had a nightmare, but notices that his goldfish has 2 fins. He takes it to the pet shop and complains. And she says that Stephen came in the previous day to get a fish. Stephen sees the clock and realizes that it's the afternoon and his date for Dylan is in a couple hours. He goes to the steakhouse and waits and then calls Dylan. Dylan tells him that the date was 2 days ago on Friday and Stephen never showed. Stephen doesn't know where the missing 2 days went and a waiter confirms that it's Sunday. And after having a meal, Stephen calls his mother, leaves a voicemail praising Dylan and walks home. Depressed, he eats chocolate that he had brought for Dylan. Checking the floor, Stephen finds scrapes from the table and spots a loose board in the wall above. He finds car keys and a flip phone with missed calls from Layla on the ladder. Layla calls and says that she's texting and calling him for months and he never got back to her. She comments on how he now has a British accent and calls Stephen Mark. When Stephen asks her why she called him Mark, she hangs up. Stephen's voice speaking with an American accent tells Stephen to stop or he'll get himself in trouble. When Stephen looks for the source of the voice, he sees that his reflection in the darkened bathroom shaking his head at him. The lights in the flat flicker and the reflection in the mirror tells Stephen to stop looking. The building shakes and Stephen runs to the lift. All right, Tim. So we get this obviously took a couple of days, this whatever happened with him. And we have the introduction of Layla. So what's going on here?
Well, I am now firmly to the point where I don't give a shit about Stephen Grant's civilian life or identity. So as far as this, you missed our date. I mean, that's just whatever. Like, I'm not invested in that storyline whatsoever. But it does establish that quite a bit of time has passed, unbeknownst to our main character. And so he's sort of figuring things out. And the lines are blurring now between the lives of Stephen Grant and this dude Mark Spector, and we're wondering why is that. So that's sort of being set up as one mystery off to the side. It seems like there is a reason for it, but we're not too sure what that is. And the show is maybe interested in exploring that, as am I. This character Layla, I understand is also unique to this show. I don't know how I feel about that necessarily. Again, I'm not the biggest Moon Knight fan in the world. But it sort of seems like, why do you have, the titular character, but seemingly like none of his supporting cast? I'm not saying he's got it comes from the richest group of characters out there in terms of having like known arch enemies and allies and associates and stuff, but he does have a supporting cast, and it's, I don't know why they're sort of stepping over established characters to give us like all these new characters to the show. But I guess that does help me prevent me from spinning my wheels, like you said, Andy, where I'm trying to figure out who all these guys are supposed to be when I, you know, can go to Wikipedia and be like, Layla, who? And like, oh, okay, she's
Layla
for the show.
Sorry, Tim.
Yeah, you got it. I was thinking, I had it in my head, it wasn't going to come out until you had to go there, Shifley.
You should be glad that I know that song.
I'm rather impressed. So it came out before, you know, 1999, so you know it. Tim, you have anything else to add? Or
no, I'm good.
Okay. So. All right. Scott?
No, I was shocked with how many days had passed with it. And I was kind of heartbroken when, like, the date, and you find out, like, A, he didn't even know he was going to have a date till like, a couple days before. And, like, he goes to the steakhouse, and you can tell he doesn't know anything about steak because he's like, I'll have the nicest one. And they're like, how do you want it made? And he's like, I want it well done. Yeah, that's great. So, obviously, Steven doesn't know anything about steak because well-done steak is terrible. Like, my dad likes it. I don't know how he eats basically carcass. I don't get it. Fried carcass, whatever.
That scene was offensive, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like...
My girlfriend likes it well done. I'm like, ugh. Medium rare is the way to go.
Yeah, I do medium, but yeah, it's just like he's a mess. Like that, Steven's just a mess. Like when he's getting the new fish, and he's like, "You were here a couple days ago," and he's like, "That's the time I just woke up." So obviously, Mark does a great job of covering his bases. When, like, to make Steven believe, like, you're not wandering out at night, so stuff like that. So it seems like Mark's always two steps ahead of where Steven is, this Mark that we see. But Steven starts catching up on his own. Like, he finds, like, the scrapes from the table, and he sees that Layla has called him. And then we start seeing, like, maybe he is losing his mind because someone's talking to him. He's hearing multiple voices in his head, his own voice. He's hearing this other voice call him an idiot all the time. And he should start doubting his own sanity, which he already does, obviously, because he locks himself in at night like he's a werewolf or something.
Yeah, or like a vampire, you know. Yeah, he hears voices in his head. They call to me, they come to me, they whatever. Trying to quote the Randy Orton song. Yes. Anyway. All right, so Steven, he's in the lift, and the lift goes down. It opens on a darkened hallway. A bird-headed cloaked humanoid charges at Steven, but the doors close, and an old woman enters the lift. Steven is crouched on the floor and claims he lost his contact lens. The woman quickly gets out, and when the lift stops at a lower floor, when Steven turns, he sees the figure. He blacks out and wakes up on the bus and sees the figure standing on the street. It disappears as the bus passes, and Steven quickly gets off the bus. Looking back, Steven sees Harrow on the bus and realizes that the man is real. Going into the museum, Steven tells the front desk guard to keep an eye out because he's being followed. Donna comes up and asks Steven to take the inventory downstairs, and Steven sees a man from the bus. He ignores Donna and follows the man into the Egyptian wing. Harrow approaches and admits he's surprised to see that Steven is real. The guard comes over and reveals the tattoo on his arm, and Harrow thanks him for helping. More of the cultists step out, and Harrow tells Steven that the scarab belongs to Amit. Harrow says that Amit grew weary of waiting for evildoers to commit their crimes, so he punishes them based on what she can see of their destiny. Amit knows that what they will do and punishes them accordingly. The cultists cut off Steven's attempts to escape, and Harrow says that Amit was betrayed by indolent fellow gods and even her own avatar. All right, so he wakes, you know, we get our first image, I guess, of Khonshu, I guess that's who it is. And Steven, you know, is back at work. He talks to Scotty, the idiot guard, and we get the first real interaction between Harrow and Steven. Scott, what'd you make of it?
First off, I take offense to you saying Scotty, the idiot guards. I think that's a shot at me, Andy. Watch tone.
It always is. It is.
The woman, like, he's clearly losing his mind with the, like, he's seen things, but it's just like this woman on. So it's like, I'm not saying he's an unreliable narrator, but that might be something we have to keep in mind as the show goes on, potentially. Just, I'm throwing that out there. I know nothing. It just seems like if he's seen what he thinks is Khonshu, but it's some old bat trying to get on an elevator, then we should be, you know, watching out. But I did like where, like, we see that Harrow has cultists everywhere because like it's the guard. Like he even says the guard's name. The guard reveals the tattoo, and Harrow's like, "Thanks for helping." And then like these people come out of the shadows of the museum, and they're like sinking in on him. And we see like we start learning about avatars, which I think is very important for the show, because obviously Mark and Steven are avatars for Khonshu, and Harrow is an avatar for Amit, which, you know, screw weary evildoers waiting to commit the crime. So just like I said with the Minority Report, she's trying to get ahead of the crime and take care of it. So and like Amit seems like she got out of control with wanting to stop crime before it started. So that's why, like, you can't have someone guilty for something they haven't done yet. And I think that's where they're going. And we've already seen that earlier where that woman's life force got sucked away. So Amit seems to be a bad bitch, basically.
Mm-hmm. All right. Tim?
Yeah, this is more the type of thing that I am on board for and wanted to see from this series, which is making us question, as Scott put it, the reliability of our protagonist slash narrator. And that, you know, what's the saying? Just because you're crazy doesn't mean they're not out to get you. This is sort of the inverse of that, where it's like, just because they are out to get you doesn't mean you're not also crazy, where it can be both things, right? We know that he is switching between these two identities, that there's two people in here kind of jockeying for a position, and that, you know, he is an avatar of this god of the moon, Khonshu, but he also might be completely off his rocker, you know? And perhaps has been his whole life. We don't know that much about the history of Mark or Stephen Grant. So I like that little ambiguity. I like the show playing with these questions, and I like the creepy and very horrifying visions that, again, are making you question, are we really seeing this? Is this happening, or is this just in the main character's head? So that's more of what I'm down for. So I enjoyed this little sequence thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. All right, so the lights flicker, and Harrow tells Stephen that the voice in his head must be maddening. He reveals his arm tattoo and takes Stephen's wrist. He judges Stephen and says that there's chaos in him. More tourists come in, and Stephen slips out past the open door. That night, Stephen is doing inventory alone in the museum. The lights go out, and Stephen walks to the exit. He hears a dog whining and goes to investigate, and a dog-like creature moves into the darkness behind him. Stephen sees a shadow of a creature ahead and hides behind a case. Harrow speaks through the intercom and tells Stephen to give him the scarab, and he'll be spared. Stephen tosses his backpack out, and the creature leaps on it and then runs after Stephen. Stephen runs and takes refuge in a restroom. Mark appears in the mirrors telling Stephen that he can save them, but he can't have Stephen fighting them. Stephen agrees, and then the creature breaks through the door and leaps on Stephen. A hooded figure that has taken Stephen's body over beats the creature down. So, yeah, quite the something that we kind of saw in the trailers. It was actually a jackal, to be more specific. But, you know, I like that we get an image of Moon Knight, you know, in action before the first episode ends. So, Tim, what do you think of the closing moments of this episode?
Okay, the jackal is very cool. I thought that was maybe a nod again to the character's origins.
Damn
in the
it.
Comics from,
you know, that's what I was thinking too, Tim.
Yeah, it was a werewolf by night thing. So it's like, is this sort of a wolf-like creature? So I don't know. That was the impression that I got from this. And they are working on a Werewolf by Night, Halloween special, I want to say, for Disney Plus. Is that, I don't know if that's this year or next year, but anyway, I'm not sure if that was intended or not, but the fact that Scott thought of it as well makes me think that it was. So yeah, now we get the costume, which like manifests out of nowhere. That's new. Wasn't really expecting it to work that way. It's also seemingly all CGI. I mean, it looks pretty badass, but I don't know. I'm sort of torn between would I rather see a performer in a costume versus this this approach that they take in the show. But they're going full supernatural. Like, they're going full mystical, like, you know, shape-shifting costume. And this is where, I hate to say it, I was like, all right, so we're doing Disney Plus Venom? Like, I mean, right down to, it's not, again, not Batman. We're doing, and not comics Venom, we're doing Sony Spider-Man universe Venom. We've got a transforming costume. We've got a snarky voice in a guy's head, and our protagonist is sort of a schlubby idiot in the vein of Tom Hardy's Eddie Brock. Like, I mean, that's three big check boxes that this show. Maybe it's a coincidence, but it just, I don't know. With Venom already being out there in the wild, it invites way too much comparison for me. And I'm like, ooh, I don't know about this. Especially the voice of Khonshu being like such an asshole. That is so like the symbiote from Venom. I feel like they should have maybe course corrected especially after two Venom movies now, where that's sort of their gimmick. It's just, it's a little too close for comfort for me. So, yeah, I hate, like, on the one hand, I do like the costume, but I hate that it immediately drew that comparison for me in my head. So, and I don't know if that's just a me thing or if other people are out there saying that. I haven't really kept up with reviews of the show, but that's the first thing that struck me.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I mean, there's been other movies or, you know, TV shows that have had that plot device, but I can definitely see the stench of Venom is still very the movie is still very present, I guess, so to speak. Especially the second one. The first one I kind of liked. Second one, though. Yeah, it got a little much. I mean, I don't love those movies at all, but you know, they're not fucking Morbius at least. All right, so Scott,
it's not even that it's bad because Venom sucks. I mean, I do kind of think Venom sucks, but it's bad because it's just too derivative. You know, it's too similar to something that's already out there. Even if Venom was the greatest thing in the world, I would still have a problem with this being mm-hmm. so similar.
Yeah, similar plot devices in movies or TV shows. I totally get that. Scott, what do you think of the end of the episode?
I liked where Harrow tried to judge Steven, but was unable to. He just said that he's like that there's chaos in him, and like I guess maybe Harrow has the same issue as Steven because he knows that there's different voices in his head. So maybe Harrow is a person with DID as well. And that's how these, you know, these Egyptian gods are able to attach themselves to these people because their mind is so fractured, it's easy to slip in. So maybe that's could be something we see later on. I, like Tim, I thought it was the werewolf. I thought that was a nice little callback to that. And I did like how, like you said, Andy, with the very end, with like we see a Moon Knight costume and he's beating the shit out of this dog. This was the same scene we had seen in the trailer. And I know they like to ruin stuff in the trailer, so it was nice to get that out of the way in episode one and not like the end of episode five or the middle of episode six. We see like this happening. And I liked the costume. I thought it was pretty badass. I didn't even think of the Venom thing until Tim brought it up in our chat. But I can sort of see how it's Venom, but it's not as comedic as Venom, in my opinion. So I think it works for me okay. If they were talking about eating people or eating chickens and stuff like they do in Venom 2, I'd be like, yeah, here it is. But it kind of works for Mark or Steven because he already has DID. So, you know, it could be many of the voices talking to him and not just Khonshu.
I think they're walking on a fine line right now, between it being acceptable and it being like ridiculous. And it's very, hopefully they stay to the one side, not the other. Oh yeah, but I could definitely see Tim. But now, like, you guys are talking about Werewolf by Night and everything, like, do we get this tied into, like, Black Knight? Do we get it tied into Blade? I mean, because they're in London right now. I mean, we're going to do a little globe trotting here. But I'm starting to think, like, you know, the mad, you know, scientist Feige is just stringing us all along, and he's you know, he's gonna get us to where he wants us to be. So, you know, I'm here for it though. I am. Go ahead.
Well, Andy, they did say that. I think this is bullshit what I'm about to say, but I'm just re-saying what they said. They said that Moon Knight has nothing to do with the MCU. Call him bullshit on that. I think at the very end, we're gonna see something not with that garden store Arthur asshole Black Knight. We're gonna see something with Blade, a true hero.
Now, I think what they said was that it doesn't have any attachment to anything in the MCU yet. You know, like coming in, it has like no, there's nothing else going on here. You know what I mean? Like everything else.
Yeah.
Something is that correct? Like something. In fact, like it's like. It's not part of the MCU, I guess, yet, but it will be by the time the series is over. It's like
I read that to me. That's sort of reading between the lines, which I think you sort of have to do with those types of statements. I just took it as Oscar Isaac isn't signed for anything else besides these six episodes of Moon Knight. They probably want to tie it into other things, but they haven't, you know, made those deals yet.
Yeah. I think there'll be something, some connective tissue by the end of the series here. I mean, they're not going to just give us this character for six episodes and never have them appear again, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, the fact that they're going full supernatural with the character who, I mean, he has a supernatural origin in the comics, but he's more of a, I don't know, more of a street level type hero in the vein of Daredevil than he is like a Blade type of character. But I guess they're changing that direction for this show to maybe make it consistent or possibly make it line up with whatever they're going to do with Blade and whatever bullshit they're tying Black Knight in with that, which I still don't know where they're going with that, but anyway, you're gonna get me ranting about Eternals again.
All right, let's try to avoid that. So well, guys, we got double duty to do, so let's continue on. So we're gonna talk about episode two, Summon the Suit. So this picks up right where we left off with Steven waking up in his flat and the sounds of the dying jackal creature ringing in his head. He leaps out of bed and falls to the floor. The restraint on his ankle brings him up short. Steven goes to the bathroom mirror and tells Mark to show himself, but gets no response. He goes to the museum and finds the devastation from the previous night caused by the jackal. JB says that the authorities are claiming burst pipes, but he doesn't believe it. The security guard goes to check out the security footage, and Steven tags along. Steven says what JB is going to see is bonkers, and JB rolls the tape, and it shows Steven, but not the jackal. The tape eventually shows Mark glaring at the camera. Later, the head of security calls Steven to his office at the museum, isn't pressing charges. He gives Steer a flyer for a sanitarium and tells Steven to hand over any museum property he has, which is actually only his name tag. Later, Steven sits with the street performer and tells him what happened. He says that he found things hidden in his flat and convinces himself to go to the storage locker. He does so with one of the keys he found, and the attendant recognizes him and takes him to the locker. So that's how we start the episode off. Scott, what do you think of it?
I like how we start off hot, Andy. Like we see, like Steven wakes up and, you know, he doesn't know what he can believe or not. But Mark put him to bed again, you know, locked the door, put the tape on and put his restraint on. And then, like, I love how he talked to the security guard, and he's like, you're going to see some crazy shit. And it's just Mark mean mugging the camera, which we see, we're not told why later, but in this later episode, we see that other people can't see these projections, which may lead into what I said with episode one, a possible I mean, it's not an unreliable narrator because we'll have Layla there, but like only they can see this. So it's like, not only is he hearing voices, but he's seeing shit that no one else can see, which is pretty crazy. And I might be symbolic with him just giving up his name tag, because I'm getting ahead of myself here. I'm sorry, Andy, but Steven's also going to give up something else bigger at the end of the episode. He's already given up his name now.
Mm-hmm. Look at you. That's fair. Yeah, I feel like the judge in My Cousin Vinny when, you know, Vinny finally says something like really, you know, smart, and you're like, fair, that was very good. Overruled. All right. Tim, go ahead. No, I'm kidding. I thought that was actually a really good point.
I'm
jealous of you, Schiff.
Yeah,
I have good, a, every once in a while.
Good reading sunshine. Into the symbolism by the Ute Scott here. that was bad. Yeah, I mean, this is sort of the two Utes. I guess this is the Stephen Grant problem that I'm continuing to have with the show. I don't care about any of this shit with his job or his coworkers or, you know, this, and it's there because it kind of has to be. And I hate that it has to be there. Cause I'm just done with this useless idiot. And I shouldn't be saying that two episodes in. I fully grant you. I realized that. We go through the motions here, and this just further illustrates Scott's earlier point that Mark is very good, very, very good at covering his tracks and cleaning up after himself and not getting caught, acting in the capacity of Stephen Grant here and putting him back to bed, of course. This is sort of just getting us from point A to point B. I think we're getting, maybe my issue is this, we're getting a lot of plot in these first two episodes, but we're not really getting a lot of character. Like that's going to start to change here, admittedly, in the second outing. We're going to learn more about Mark Spector, I think, but I really don't think we've learned much about Stephen Grant. And maybe if I knew more about what kind of person he is or what kind of person he's supposed to be, that I would have maybe some attachment to him, at least that I wouldn't be so dismissive of his scenes. But we're not really getting a very full picture of what he's like. And I guess that's by design, because it would be maybe giving too much away, but you got to give me something. I mean, come on, show.
All right, so Stephen goes in and finds Egyptian artifacts on the shelves, as well as a cot and clothes, as if somebody was living there. There's a duffel bag with a pistol inside, as well as bundles of money and a passport made out to Mark Spector. The scarab is also in the bag, and it flies in the air on its own when Stephen touches it. Mark appears in a reflection within the metal walls and tells Stephen that he wasn't supposed to see any of it. He says that he can save Stephen, but Stephen has to go to sleep and let him take control. Stephen refuses and demands an explanation. Mark says that he's an avatar of Khonshu, the Egyptian god of the moon, which means Stephen and they protect the vulnerable and they administer justice to those who hurt them. Stephen doesn't believe it, and Mark says that his deal with Khonshu is contingent with Stephen not interfering. When Stephen says that he's going to take the bag to the authorities and they'll lock him up, the lights flicker, and Stephen runs out and closes the locker door behind him. One of the mummy creatures approaches Stephen, and he runs the other way. The creature appears ahead of him, and Stephen runs out of the building and trips on the street. Layla pulls up on a motorcycle and figures Stephen is Mark and asks where he's been. She gives Stephen a lift on her motorcycle and drives off and explains that she tracked him via his phone. Stephen reluctantly puts his arms around her waist to hold on, and Layla complains about what Mark put her through when he disappeared on her. He says that she's still his wife. Stephen wonders if they're married and says that his confusion isn't an act, and he'll tell her everything once she gets him to his flat. So we get, you know, some more Mark reveals with Stephen, and a little bit of Howling Barrow and then battle, and then the mysterious Layla finally makes an appearance. So Tim, what's going on here?
Oh God, it's again, a lot of plot gets thrown at us, and we're getting some answers, some exposition from Mark. So it's I guess that's appreciated. Although it's, again, not really anything we aren't already figuring out on our own. I'm feeling like, again, maybe this is just me, the comics reader with my limited Moon Knight knowledge, but I'm just, it's feeling a bit tedious. And at first I was going to say it's awfully convenient the way that Layla just happens to roll up in the nick of time here, but she does establish that she was tracking him by the phone, right? So she was already looking for him. So they kind of smooth that over, but again, I don't know. I just feel like I'm kind of going through the paces here. It's not really grabbing me like I want it to so far.
All right. Scott.
Spoiler alert. I really enjoyed this part. I like how it told some story and with it, cause I like seeing Steven and Mark go against each other. And I like how it's not just being done in their heads, but off of reflections of mirror or like, you know, or even a spoon, as we'll see later on. And I love how, like, it seems that Mark's trying to protect Steven, but it also brings up a question. Who do we think is the real quote unquote Moon Knight? Is it Mark or is it Steven? I know there's a third one in the comics, Tim, but who is the real Moon Knight? Is Steven just an imagination? Because I think Steven is, because I said in episode one where he keeps calling his mom that, like, I don't think his mom's there. I don't think she's real. You get what I'm saying? So maybe right. Mark is the real one, and Steven is the one, like, he uses when he needs a quote-unquote break from reality. So, because, like, even Mark says they protect the vulnerable and minister justice to those who hurt them, and Mark says that his deal with Khonshu is contingent with Steven not interfering. So it seems like Mark's the one that made the deal with Khonshu, and he knew about Steven, and, like, he's the one pulling the strings. I was shocked that Layla is Mark's wife. And Steven's even shocked, but, like, you know, he's like, oh, you know, we'll go from there. But it's very interesting. I'm glad we got to finally meet Layla. I'm glad it was showed up on episode two and not episode three or four. We need to have them together. I don't know if she'll be the romantic lead the whole time, but it's nice. You know, Oscar Isaacs needs someone to play off of.
Yeah, definitely. I think Mark could be like a manifestation of, you know, the other side of the personality, so to speak. Like, he seems to be kind of the opposite of Mark in every way. So maybe he's, you know, what happens when it gets a little harrowing or Mark needs a break, he becomes Steven. Who knows? I mean, we got, you know, hopefully four more episodes. They'll kind of clue us in. What the dynamic is.
These are great questions, and I think they're great questions because they're really character-centered questions. It's like, who's the real Moon Knight? Well, we think Mark was the one who made the deal, but at the same time, like, whose body is this? Like, when this guy was born, assuming he was born conventionally, like who's, was this Steven or was this Mark? And how, you know, have they always, when did this, if it's a DID situation, you know, when did that start? Or is there more of a supernatural element to it where, like, somehow these guys have gotten, you know, mashed together in one body? Like, just really cool identity-centered and character-centered questions that I guess I'm wishing the show would spend some more time with, because we seem to find them pretty interesting, and we still got time. It's just two episodes. I don't know. I wanted to get more into these meatier types of questions, sort of from the outset.
All right, cool. So the I lost my place now. Here we go. Scott, you go, right? Sorry, I didn't go to you yet.
I've already spoken.
Oh, you have?
I just was adding an aside.
Oh, okay. So what thing? Sorry, I'm late. The couple goes to the flat, and Mark appears in the aquarium reflection and tells Steven that Layla shouldn't be there. He tells Layla that his mother's flat and it's his mother's flat, and it figures that Stephen and Mark are talking again. Layla has the divorce papers. Mark sent her, and Stephen says that he'd never divorce her. He tells Layla that Mark is a right twit and shows her the bag. Mark appears in the mirror and tells Stephen to stop, and Stephen will get, if he doesn't, he will get Layla killed when they come to after her to get the scarab. Stephen reconsiders, but Layla grabs the bag and finds the scarab, says they fought side by side to get it. He tells Layla that she can have it, and he's not Mark, and thinks Layla is the only one who could help him. Layla figures that Stephen doesn't remember their lives together. There's a knock on the door, and Stephen figures that they've come for him. It's the police, and Stephen lets him in. The two officers barge in, and Stephen says that he's the only one there. Layla is hiding outside the window, and the officers look around but don't find her. They find a bag and the passport and Mark's name, and they tell him to come with them. The officers, Billy and Bobby, handcuff Stephen and drive him away in their car. They check the police database and confirm that Mark was part of the team of mercenaries that hit a dig site in Egypt and killed the archaeologist there. They drive to a warehouse and see, and Mark sees the Amit tattoos on their wrist. They leave Stephen alone and go in. Mark appears in the window reflection to tell Stephen that he doesn't need to fight him. He should just surrender control. Stephen refuses to ever give Mark control, and Howard appears and opens the door, causing Stephen to fall on the pavement along with the officers. All right, Scott, so we get a little more backstory here with Layla, and Stephen takes a trip. So what's going on?
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, Stephen's quick to say, I would never divorce you. It's because the man is not getting any poontang. But it's just, like, I think Layla will get killed by the end of this. It's going to be because of because Mark says you're going to get her killed with her getting involved. And I think that's what's going to happen. And when we find out that Layla may be a mercenary too, because she says they fought side by side to get the scarab. So I think that's pretty interesting. It shows that she can be a badass. And the cops come in, and I will give credit to Oscar Isaacs, because he plays the meek Steven that doesn't really do it. Like, you don't think him as being like a presence, like a violent presence at all, very well. But like, when he switches to Mark, it's like a light switch going on and off. So I think that so I will give props to Oscar Isaacs for doing that. Like, I know some people aren't a big fan of his accent, but the way he plays it, it's like, he's like, oh, like when the cops come, like he's scared. And then they find the bag and the passport, Mark's name. And damn, how many people does this cult have in their back pocket? Cause we found out it was the security guard at the museum last episode. This episode's the two cops, and they take him in, and, then Hera opens the door and Steven just falls on his ass. And I like the way the camera showed him just falling out of the car. It was on his face the whole time as he hits the ground. Really good scene. And you say that Ethan Hawke's doing a Kevin Bacon impersonation. I've always loved Ethan Hawke as an actor. So I think he's just chewing up the scenery every scene he's in.
Yeah, I'm just saying, but more of a cosplay, how's that?
Okay.
He's doing, yeah, because he kind of looks like, if you look quickly, it's Kevin Bacon. But it's also kind of like evoking, it wasn't that long ago, but what the hell was that group in Falcon and Winter Soldier, like where they just started popping up everywhere? You didn't know their numbers, how big they were until the Flag Smashers. So we're getting some similar this here. But yeah, Oscar Isaac, I think also too that when he is Stephen, he's being like overly British, like using a lot of British terminology and slang, a lot more than most Brits would, I guess, so to speak. That's how I'm seeing it now that it's being a little more discussed. Tim, what do you think of this part of the episode?
I definitely liked seeing that switch flip, rather than editing and cutting around when Steven goes into Mark mode. The build up to it, I kind of thought was more frustrating than suspenseful, because he's going to do it. He's just got to get pushed to that point. But I don't know, me watching the show, I'm just sitting there thinking, just hand it over to Mark, you fucking idiot. Let's just get on with it. I thought that Mark kind of took his sweet time and telling Steven that, you know, you're going to get Layla killed if you don't cooperate and you don't listen to me. Like, maybe you open with that. Like, he's already on to you. You can't keep this guy in the dark, but to a certain extent here. At the same time, Steven knows he is way over his head. Just let Mark take over at this point. I'm like, I don't need this back and forth. As clever as it is sort of done visually, I'm just kind of over it now. Again, after a grand total of two episodes here, but it was very cool seeing him just performance wise, like as an actor, to see Oscar Isaac do that was great. And, I love the comparison, Ethan Hawke to Kevin Bacon. I guess I was trying to figure out who he reminded me of, just appearance-wise. And I think he hit the nail on the head, Andy. But I just continue to find the character, for all his scenery chewing, very compelling. I'm pretty into him as a character. So
yeah,
that has got me. Yeah, still pretty. Captivated.
Yeah, that's why I'm here, to make those comparisons. The heart, you're not gonna find that anywhere else, so come on, people. All right, so Harrow says that they needed time to understand Steven's situation and unlocks the handcuffs. He wonders if Khonshu chose Steven as his avatar because his mind was already broken and he's there to help Steven. The mummy creature Khonshu appears to Steven and tells him to kill Harrow, and Harrow admits that he can't see Khonshu anymore. Taking Steven through the neighborhood, Harrow tells Steven that the neighborhood used to have the highest crime rate in the city, and he says that Khonshu always tries to recruit those with a strong moral conscience, and Khonshu continues to tell Steven to kill Harrow. Harrow says that Khonshu often throws temper tantrums, and none of the other gods respect him. Khonshu insists that he only punishes those who have done harm, and he's real justice. Harrow explains that he was Khonshu's former avatar, and Khonshu's retribution comes too late for the people who have suffered. Amit destroys evil before evil is done. That's why they have to resurrect her. Steven isn't convinced, and Harrow insists that Amit will light the path to good by eradicating the choice of evil. As the cultists move closer, Harrow tells Steven that the scarab can lead them to Amit's tomb. He asks Steven for the scarab, and Steven says that he doesn't have it. Mark appears in a disc reflection and tells Steven not to mention Layla and give him the body. Harrow talks to Mark and says that Khonshu is a liar and already demands one last mission. So we get like this like commune almost type situation here, and we find out that Harrow was a Khonshu avatar. Tim, this is where I start to get a little confused. What's happening here?
Well, yeah, I sort of wonder as well how truthful Arthur Harrow is being when he says that he was a former avatar before Mark Spector of Khonshu. It seems like, I don't know, it just seems like you shouldn't be able to bounce between Egyptian gods as their different avatars like that. I don't know what these rules are. They haven't really told us, but it seems a little bit suspect. So I'm not sure if I'm fully buying into that one yet. Because why would Khonshu let this guy go? If it's just a case where he fulfilled his service, then okay, he did let him go. So why is he still sort of mixed up in all of this? Still some unanswered questions here. We don't know exactly how or when Mark Spector came into the mix, as the new avatar. And, Khonshu is getting some characterization, such as it is, as sort of this petulant god who's a real asshole, and when he doesn't get his way, he tends to throw fits and gets no respect. So again, more kind of too similar to Venom for me, but they haven't gone completely over the top comedic. I will grant you that, but I'm wanting to see more of the backstory here. Which I think we're getting. I think we're building up to. They're just kind of keeping that one up their sleeve, to keep us on the hook.
All right. Scott.
I really love this part. And Khonshu is the Rodney Dangerfield of these Egyptian gods. He gets no respect, obviously. But a big revelation with Harrow saying he used to be the avatar for Khonshu, and maybe if Khonshu leaves, maybe another Egyptian god could jump to Mark/Steven, because Harrow's now Amrit's avatar. So it's very interesting. Sorry, Amit. And like we see the good that Harrow has done. Like, yes, it's a cult, but like, you know, he's saying how the crime rate was the highest in the city. Now he even says like, now people don't even have to lock their doors. And I'm like, fuck that noise. Lock your doors all the time. But like, you know, they're building all these like fruits and vegetables for everyone. And it seems to be a happy little commune. You know, they just have to purge some people that may be bad every once in a while. So I like how it's showing that like, he's not, it's sort of like the Flag Smashers, where that girl, the ginger girl that Sean hated,
I don't remember her name either, so it's fine.
I just remember that picture he sent of the person from Halloween Town and said that was her. Anyway, but like how they were trying to do good.
Carly. Morgan,
yes.
Target down,
yeah. Okay.
Yes. So like, you know, she's doing something with violence, but like they're also trying to do something good as well. But it's still not the right thing to do of like killing people before they do something quote unquote bad. But the scarab is like a big thing with this, and I want to see more of the scarab, because I've been obsessed with scarabs since The Mummy, and like we would see the little scarabs eat those people alive, which terrified me as a 9-year-old, but it's pretty awesome. But no, like, and I'm just really enjoying this part. I like seeing Oscar Isaacs and Ethan Hawke together with this, because they're both just playing off each other so well.
Yeah, it's a good dynamic we've gotten so far. So continuing on, Steven wonders if Amit would kill a child for something they would do in 30 years, and Harrow admits that sometimes the cure is harsh. Steven realizes that the cultists all believe the same thing, and he draws the line at child murder. Harrow holds up his cane and explains that it holds a sliver of Amit's power, and he doesn't want to use it. He demands that Steven tell him where the scarab is, and Layla steps out and says that she has it. Layla steps out with the scarab and says, tell Steven to summon the suit and keep the scarab safe. She leads Steven to the upper level while Harrow slams his cane into the floor, and stones glow with mystical energy, and another of the jackal creatures comes through. Steven and Layla take refuge in a room and barricade the door. Layla tells Steven that his name is Mark, and she's seen him use the suit. Mark appears in a nearby reflection, tells Steven to let him in. Steven clutches at his head and says that he can't do it, and they should all stop tormenting him. Layla apologizes and says that they'll find another way, and starts climbing. So, you know, we're starting to the tension's starting to build here. Scott, what do we got happening here?
You know, I'm glad that Steven is okay with some old broad dying, but like draws a hard line in the sand when we're starting to kill kids. But you know, I like this scene. Layla does something stupid. She should never stepped out with the scarab, but we had to move that plot along, and like telling Steven to summon the suit. And then he's like, I can't do it. I can't do it. She still slapped the shit out of him, because we saw what happened at the end of the first episode where he had the badass suit and, you know, killed the jackal. But she's like, we'll figure out another way. She should have just smacked the hell out of him and like, you know, wake up, Mark, wake up, you know, but it doesn't seem she wants to go that way. She seems to respect Steven for some strange reason. But I know it's moved the plot on, but it's just a dumb for her to step out when no one was suspecting her of being there, in my opinion.
Yeah. You wanted her to slap the Steven out of him, basically.
Yes.
All right. Tim, what's happening?
I think that's a great point. I think that's an ingenious solution to this little problem, too. I mean, we don't know necessarily if the body loses consciousness, that automatically like that Mark can take over. But I mean, he seems to be able to while Steven is asleep. So why not just knock this fucker out and let's get on with it. as I keep saying. That'd be a fine way to handle this this conflict. But yeah, all that is to say, I'm tired of this cat and mouse bullshit. Just give us Mark, give us Moon Knight, enough fucking Stephen Grant. I know I'm sounding like a broken record here, but like this is the show, and I'm like, God damn it, why are we doing so much of this? Yeah, as far as the commune thing with Arthur Harrow, it's like, yeah, it's so peaceful. People don't have to lock their doors at night. It's such a spirit of community, da da da. And it's like, well, really, when you're living in fear of getting your life force sucked out at any given moment because of something you might do at some unforeseen time in the future, I guess that is one way of enforcing and keeping the peace. You know, if you're just gonna, the threat of Minority Report is looming over you at any given moment. So yeah, I think that sort of answers that question of how he's able to pull this thing off. But hey, we're getting more Jackals, and I'm fully in support of more Jackals in this series because we get some pretty good action scenes out of that.
All right, very good. So the Jackal, it bursts through the doors, and only Steven can see it. It lunges at Steven, knocking him out a window. When Steven lands, he's wearing a white business suit and a mask. Mark appears in a nearby reflection, asks Steven what they're wearing, and tells him that he isn't wearing Khonshu's ceremonial suit. Layla drops down nearby, and the Jackal throws Steven, Mr. Knight, through a nearby gate in front of her. The creature knocks Layla away and then throws Mr. Knight around, and Layla hits the Jackal with a discarded bottle. She stabs it with the broken bottle, and it knocks her away. Mark tells Steven to give him control because Steven can't handle it. Mr. Knight taunts the Jackal into coming at him and punches it. It kicks him out into the street. He fights the invisible to others Jackal, and the pedestrians think Mr. Knight is drunk. A car hits Mr. Knight and the Jackal, and Mark tells Mr. Knight that someone is going to get hurt if he doesn't let Mark in. Mr. Knight agrees, and the ceremonial suit appears on Steven as Mark takes over. Moon Knight starts climbing, luring the Jackal after him. He runs across the rooftops, lures the Jackal into following him, and slams it down on the obelisk. It fades into dust upon death, and the suit disappears. Mark realizes the scarab isn't on him. So, you know, Tim, you're, like you said, more Jackal. And we get this Mr. Knight, I guess, is what him in that like kind of business suit almost kind of deal. Mm-hmm. So we have another personality, so to speak. So break this part down.
The Mr. Knight, I'm already taking issue with this. I'm about to cut a promo on your right, Andy, because
it's IMDb.
They're conflating the comics. What they're doing is they're conflating the comics with the show, and there's been no indication whatsoever that just this costume is another separate identity for the character. Oh. The way that I interpreted this scene was simply Stephen Grant manifesting the costume or a costume rather than Mark Spector manifesting the costume, which we saw at the end of the first episode, and it was, you know, cloak, cape, classic Moon Knight. And I think the suggestion here is that when Steven does it, he doesn't really know what he's doing, and this is what we get. Now, that's not exactly made clear by the show, so I'm not going to say it's truly one thing or the other. I thought this scene was really pretty clunky because it read like the producers, the writers, whoever wanted to get that costume into the series because it is a really cool costume, but they didn't really know how to do it. So it was just like, how about this? And it doesn't come across with a lot of clarity. They might circle back to this. Maybe they do provide some explanation for it, but as presented, it seems very arbitrary why, Steven would come up with this specific form when he, I guess, tries to become Moon Knight, which I'm not even sure that's really what he was doing. Like, it's just very clunky, I thought, the way that they did this. In the comics, yes, that identity is referred to as Mr. Knight, it serves a specific purpose. It's when Moon Knight basically patrols a part of the city where superheroes are not really invited or not really welcome. So it's a tongue-in-cheek way of him showing up on a crime scene without being a costume vigilante. He's just a sharp-dressed individual, and this is how he does his business. So he's a superhero without really being dressed like a superhero in order to get around this, you know, some of these issues. And I can't remember where it is exactly, where it's like no capes and spandex allowed kind of thing. So it serves a very specific plot purpose, and he does refer to himself as Mr. Knight, and it's very tongue in cheek, and the and the cops and the authorities, the detectives are always like, oh, welcome, Mr. Knight. What do you make of this situation? You know, it's like he's not really a superhero, but he is. Anyway, that's more than anybody really needed to know about that. I didn't think the scene was very clear, and I didn't think that the write-up was very clear either. No fault of yours, Andy. So anyway, yeah, and then we get some more Jackal fighting. It's a little bit weird to me that no one else can see it. And I have to say, this is a bad comparison I'm making, and that I think, Andy, you're the only person who will get this. It reminded me of the climax of the Helen Slater Supergirl from the 80s.
Oh, God.
Where she's fighting, like, that invisible dragon. Because,
oh, Jesus.
Because they didn't have real? They didn't have the budget to actually do like an actual effects heavy battle, so she's just fighting like this invisible creature.
It's like when they really cut the budget of the original Batman show and they did all the battles in the dark.
Yeah, same thing. And that's just what I don't think that there was a budgetary issue here, but I mean, maybe it's just, that's what it made me think of, where he's fighting this invisible thing. And I'm like, oh God, is that what we're doing? But we do get a pretty decent payoff with classic Moon Knight impaling the thing on that obelisk, as they called it. So that was pretty cool.
All right, Scott.
And I like how it showed that only Steven/Mark can see these jackals. That's why we didn't see it on camera when they were on the video camera, when they were watching the video back for how the bathroom got messed up. And I liked how Layla couldn't really see it either, so she just had to guess where Mr. Knight was getting his ass beat. I'm glad you explained that, Tim, because I had no idea where the Mr. Knight thing came from. Like, I thought it was a little too over the top, to be honest. But you explaining it, I kind of understand it more. And I do like that now that I know that understanding. But also in the comics, isn't when he's in the suit, like, he's indestructible. He can't be beaten, correct?
I mean, he's tougher, but I wouldn't say he's necessarily indestructible. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of like body armor, you know, like the more modern depictions of Batman, where he can take a lot of damage. So yeah, he's definitely got a degree of invulnerability.
Because like, he survived that fall, and that was a pretty decent fall with the suit on.
Yeah.
And I did like how we get the Moon Knight and he's running across the tops of the buildings. I really thought that was a pretty badass. Just the look on it, I thought was amazing. And then the jackal just like, oh, there's nothing of the jackal after it dies because it turns into dust, which is a great way of how they covered their bases. But it was a little bit of a bummer when they realized that the scarab isn't there.
Yeah. Yeah, I like how Mark calls it, like, what does he call it? Like Colonel Sanders type suit or something like that. It's like I thought you told me to conjure this. Come on. So taking it home, Harrow takes the scarab and then judges the man. Harrow looks over and sees Layla, who rides away on her motorcycle. Sorry, I missed the line. A homeless man finds the scarab. Harrow finds him as Layla arrives nearby. He judges the man. Harrow takes over and sees Layla, who goes on the motorcycle. Steven then talks to Mark, appearing to him in a reflection, and says that it's horrible. Mark assures him that he's all right, and Mark says Steven that he can't have his body back right now. Steven tries to take his body back but can't. Mark tells him that something has changed. When Steven says that Mark has ruined his life, Mark tells him that when he has repaid his debt, Steven will never see him again. His servitude to Khonshu is the price that he pays. Mark insists that he didn't abandon Layla but is protecting her because Khonshu wants her as his replacement, and Mark is never going to let that happen. Khonshu appears and reminds Mark that he said Steven wouldn't interfere. Mark says that he'll handle it, and Khonshu doesn't belong to him and accuses Mark of altering the terms of their agreement. He reminds Mark that Mark was a corpse and when Khonshu found him, and Mark belongs to him. Khonshu says that Harrow has the scarab and that Mark is worth protecting. He figures that Mark enjoys the work he has for him and that they need each other. Khonshu warns that if they part, Mark may not like Kayla being his replacement. Khonshu then teleports Mark to an apartment in Egypt as we end the episode. So, Scott, we get quite a bit of talk here between Mark and Steven and Mark and Khonshu. What do you think of the ending of the episode?
Quite the role reversal, as Steven has now lost his body and has to basically watch Mark do everything with his body, which he's usually knocked out or asleep for, which, you know, is pretty telling. And I think should be pretty fun in the next episode where we fully see it as Mark instead of Steven. So, Tim, you won't have the shitty accent just in the reflection now, but not the whole time. I did like that Harrow got the scarab because we all knew just from watching TV and movies for our whole lives that this was going to happen. The bad guy was going to get what he needed. And Khonshu and Mark, you know, we thought they were, you know, on the same page, but their relationship is not, quote, as quite symbiotic as we thought, like with Venom and Eddie Brock. So it's nice to see they're now on the same page, and Mark's not letting let Khonshu take over for Layla, because it seems like maybe Hera was right that Khonshu jumps from body to body and he gets what he needs and then moves to another avatar. But it also is a little concerning where he said that Mark was dead when Khonshu came to him. So is that how the show ends, with Khonshu getting another body? And if he returns his body like that, and Mark's just going to die, and that means Steven is dead as well. And I like how we did some globetrotting with this. We went to we started in London in the first episode, went to that little village back in London again, and now we're in Egypt, hopefully, because I know like they have some, that's the genesis of Moon Knight. One of the stories they came back was like Mark was dying from a mercenary, Khonshu came to him, and that's one of the origins for that. So it's nice to see we're in Egypt, and I always love Egypt. I mentioned the Mummy movies earlier. I love like that mythology and stuff. It's always been fascinating to me. Hell, I used to watch those damn. Do you remember in the late 90s? You guys went on Fox. They were like, "We're gonna open this tomb tonight," and they spend an hour, like 55 mm-hmm. minutes, talking about it. And then the last 5 minutes, they open the tomb, and like there'd be some cool shit in there. It's like, "All right, well, we gotta go. See you later."
Vaguely, yeah. It kind of was like the old what was the Geraldo special in the 80s?
The Capone's vault.
Yeah, the Capone vault. Yeah, same idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff about that on the History Channel as well. So quite a little versed on that. All right, Tim, what do you think of the end of the episode?
So yeah, I'm glad that Mark is firmly in control now. Kind of hope we're done with Steven for a little bit longer here, on more of a permanent basis, maybe. It is definitely interesting, though, just that Steven has remained cognizant of what's happening, which we haven't seen this before. And yeah, the shoe's on the other foot. And he also tells us that it's really unpleasant, whatever, like, weird negative null space that he's been confined to. It's not a good feeling. So I imagine he'll continue to pop up and maybe be the angel on Mark's shoulder. But a little bit more explanation here that so the mercenary, Mark, was dead or dying when Khonshu selected him as the Avatar. So that's pretty consistent from the comics. Yeah, he dies and is resurrected as the agent of Khonshu. But here again, like, I'm questioning, was Stephen Grant still in the picture when all of that went down? Or is this a situation where, like, Mark Spector has been resurrected in a somebody else's body or something? Like, all these things are still kind of hanging out there. That those are the types of questions that I'm interested in getting answers to. Like I said, I think we're going to get them. The show's just kind of doling out this information, kind of drip feeding us, which I'm okay with. Still two episodes. I think it's been well paced. I've been a little bit frustrated with some of the characters and some of the character choices, but this still has a lot of potential. So I know I've been kind of harsh, I think, or maybe skewing more negative than you guys, but hey, you've got to have a voice of dissent.
Yeah, we can all have, you know.
Not going to totally bury it yet. Yeah. Not going to totally. Hey, I've learned from experience, right? After the absolute debacle of, you know, the Book of Boba Fett, which decided it could be good once it became a different show. And Hawkeye, which started out on really shaky ground, but had an amazing turnaround. I'm not gonna totally bury this one just yet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll go into the whole Boba Fett thing. I think that they messed up with they didn't manage expectations. So, but with this, like, you know, this is again an unknown entity. I reserve judgment for, like, let's see as we go, basically, the kind of thing, like, you know, until it does something or show, you know, doesn't come through on something, I'm optimistic as always on a lot of these shows here. So, any other thoughts leading in? We're like basically a third of the way through. So, Scott, anything you want to add as we go into the middle part of the season?
I kind of want to see more Moon Knight whooping ass. We've seen it in spurts, but I want to see him take on these cultists and just like, I'm not talking like Netflix Marvel shows violence, but, like, you know, I want something where we don't wake up and we see everyone dead. I want to see him, like, killing people.
Okay. Tim? Anything
I want to see him killing people. I want to see him killing people too. Enough of this off-screen bullshit. You know, let's see Moon Knight whoop some ass. I'm going to back Scott up on that.
All right, very good.
And no more invisible fight scenes either. Because I just rewatched while you guys were talking. I rewatched that climax from Supergirl on YouTube, and it is such doo-doo shit. Oh my god.
Yeah.
I can't believe they committed that to film. But anyway, maybe we'll review that one day.
Oh god. Oh yeah. That's a oof.
We need Sean for that one.
Definitely, for sure. Hopefully Sean will be back next week to review episode 3. Guys, it's great to be back. Great to hear your voices again. And you know, it's like we don't miss a step between these series. It's really the highlight of my week is getting together with you fine gentlemen. Really have a good time. So I hope you all out there had a good time listening to us. I know this was a bit of a marathon episode because, life events, you know, big, it was WrestleMania last weekend. So we really couldn't, and people were traveling and everything. So we couldn't get together, but, you know, glad we were able to get together. Hopefully Sean will be back for the next episode. If not, you know, later on in the season, and we'll have the full quartet, so to speak, together. So for the on assignment Sean Kidd and the present Scott Shiflett and Tim Capel, I'm Andy S. Thank you for joining us here on episodes 1 and 2 of Moon Knight, and we'll check you out next week for episode 3. Take care.